Sri Lanka, a small island nation located off the southern coast of India, is grappling with its biggest economic meltdown, which has fueled the political crisis and violent protests, the worst the country has seen since its independence in 1948. What began as peaceful demonstrations in late February over soaring inflation, shortage of food, and fuel and power outages have gradually morphed into a countrywide uprising. Amid the unprecedented turmoil, the sitting premier has forced to resign, but the president continues to hold the fort.
Violence in the island country erupted after a month of peaceful demonstrations over the dire economic situation that has affected all sections of Sri Lankan society. Lengthy blackouts, record inflation and shortage of food and medicine forced people into the streets against the family-run government. To foil the popular agitation, a nationwide curfew was imposed and the military was heavily deployed, but not before 9 people were killed and over 225 were wounded. The unrest and violence in the last 2 weeks is the worst the island country has seen since the 2019 Easter bombing. Angry protesters who have been demanding the ouster of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa have been attacked by pro-government mobs. Earlier, the president's brother and Prime Minister, Mahinda Rajapaksa, resigned under public pressure and fled to a notorious torture camp in the Tamil-majority region northeast. He was replaced by Ranil Wickremesinghe, a seasoned politician who has in the past been accused of facilitating corruption and fanning the long-standing ethnic conflict. The crisis in the country of 22 million is rooted in economic mismanagement by successive governments. The country has now been forced to turn to the International Monetary Fund for aid after months of denial. But that seems insufficient to pacify protesters who want a complete political shake-up, including the resignation of President Rajapaksa.
While the unprecedented economic crisis threatens to upend the nation of 22 million people, it has also caused the staggering fall of the country's most powerful political dynasty. The Rajapaksa family dominated Sri Lanka's political scene for almost 2 decades. The family's dramatic collapse was triggered by an economic crisis caused by decades of fiscal mismanagement and aggravated by populist policies. The stress eventually led to a crash. Now, most of the family members are in hiding, except the embattled president himself.
Early murmurs of the unrest were heard in late February, but it was not until early April that peaceful protests gained momentum across the small island country. The key demand raised by protesters was the resignations of the two powerful brothers, the president and prime minister. When his supporters attacked anti-government protesters, sparking clashes across the country, Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa was forced to resign. He soon had to be evacuated from his besieged home and whisked away to a safe location. While his resignation was widely welcomed, President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's refusal to walk away infuriated anti-government protesters and added fuel to the fire. Although he offered some concessions and appointed veteran politician Ranil Wickremesinghe as the new premier, protesters in the Buddhist-majority country see his exit important for the country's economic recovery.
Mr. President and also Prime Minister and also members of Parliament, please step down and stop this violence. Don't disturb us, don't disturb people, because people are suffering. You all are playing the game. You all are playing the game. So we want to say, please step down and leave us alone.
The new Prime Minister has invited the opposition to form a unity government, but they have made it conditional on President Rajapaksa's resignation. Without a stable government in place, observers believe it will be difficult for Sri Lanka to negotiate a loan with the International Monetary Fund. The efforts to seek financial help from neighboring India and China will also be hampered amid a political crisis in the country.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shiran Ilamperuma, an independent journalist and researcher. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, the small island nation of Sri Lanka is embroiled in its worst economic crisis, which has led to violent protests. Do you think it was inevitable given the economic mismanagement by successive governments?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me on your show and on your channel. As you said, it has been successive policy missteps by governments since Sri Lanka achieved independence from the British in 1948 that has led us to this point. There are structural weaknesses in the Sri Lankan economy, being basically since the time of colonialism, a plantation economy, an export-oriented plantation economy. Since the 1940s and 50s, we've been relying on exports of agricultural raw materials like tea, rubber, and coconut. And obviously, this is not enough to sustain a nation that imports manufacturers from other countries, and this leads to constant trade deficits and pressure on the currency, which leads to devaluation and inflation. It's a vicious cycle that only industrialization, and especially, at some point, export-oriented industrialization can solve. And no government has been able to implement this with a proper vision and maintain it for a long enough time. I think the current crisis in many ways exposes the Sri Lankan economy for what it has always been, right? In 1977, when the Sri Lankan economy was liberalized and opened up and connected more deeply with the global economy, we were not able to produce enough, to export enough to justify our imports. And that balance, it was basically met through a very superficial consumption-oriented service sector, predominantly tourism. And at the same time, we were exporting our labor to the Gulf countries in the Middle East. And the remittances from those workers was what we used along with tourism revenue to balance out the trade deficit. I think what the COVID-19 pandemic and now the war in Ukraine have done is basically strip Sri Lanka from those two crutches, and it exposes the real economy, the real state of the economy.
Now let's talk about the Rajapaksas. The family has been accused of fanning the decades-old ethnic conflict in Sri Lanka by leading a brutal war against LTTE, repressing minority Tamils and Muslims. How do you see their fall from grace?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think, of course, the narrative of the Rajapaksas vis-a-vis the minorities and the civil war, that's very well known internationally, and it's part of the one sort of narrative that is allowed in Western media. It's not that this is entirely a false narrative. Of course, there's truth in it. Of course, there is a degree of ethnic chauvinism embedded in the Rajapaksa political project. But, one thing I just want to clarify is that this sort of negates the actual electoral base of the Rajapaksa family, which is in the south and in the rural regions. And if you actually go to these parts of Sri Lanka in the deep south and in very rural, unindustrialized areas where people depend on paddy farming, smallholder agriculture, fisheries, you will find that ethnic chauvinism doesn't really sell because these people have real issues, right? What makes them gravitate towards the Rajapaksas is the sort of economic incentives. Basically, the Rajapaksas coming from a nominally center-left nationalist background means that they respond to the rural electorate by giving them, bare minimum, agricultural subsidies, for example, subsidized fuel, subsidized fertilizer, and protection for domestic industries. So the electoral base of the Rajapaksas, despite being of the majority community, is dependent more on these economic relationships. The chauvinism and the racial dynamics, they feature more heavily in the urban sectors, actually, in places like Colombo, where most of the chauvinistic politicians are elected from Colombo. And because that's where the economic competition between rural to urban migrants and minorities in the trading sector is most intense.
Mr. Ilan Promo, how important is a stable and united government in Colombo for the country to recover from the economic meltdown and political crisis? And do you think President Rajapaksa's resignation is a panacea?
I think a stable government is very much a necessity and a precondition to bring some semblance of normalcy. I think at this point, every political party in the country has to come together on some sort of common minimum program that will prioritize, first of all, providing essentials to the Sri Lanka people, petrol, gas, food, all of those things, you know, electricity, so that the real economy can function. There also needs to be a stable government to negotiate with the IMF, to negotiate with our bilateral partners for bridge financing, and to eventually start negotiations on restructuring our external debt. In terms of the resignation of the president, that is a strong demand that comes from a lot of the protesters in Colombo, and I think a significant amount of people in rural areas would agree with it. I personally don't see that as a panacea, because what it would do is create a power vacuum, and it's not clear from the protesters on the ground or what or who the alternative is, because there has as yet to be a leader to sort of step up and be willing to fill that vacuum.
Mr. Ilan Perumo, thank you for being on the program. Glad to have you with us. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
A Johns Hopkins economist, Steve Hank, refers to soaring food prices and violent protests in Sri Lanka and says protesters have burnt down the homes of 38 politicians as the country plunges into further chaos. Jairam Ramesh, former Indian minister and lawmaker, says the roots of Sri Lanka's crisis lie not just in short-term economics, but more in linguistic, religious and cultural majoritarianism over the past decades. Political commentator and author Ashok Swain points to Rajapaksa's family's appeal of the majority ethnic community and hate politics against Tamil Hindus and Muslims, saying the economic disaster has brought Buddhist monks to the streets.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India and Japan, the two regional stalwarts, mark 70 years of their diplomatic relations this year. The partnership between them has steadily progressed over the years, especially after the two countries became special strategic and global partners in 2015. Japan's role as a shaper of India's regional engagement and broader global outlook has been significant. Now let's take a look at what in particular has bolstered their strategically driven relationship in their close synergy in the Indo-Pacific region and opposition to China's rise.
The Japanese envoy to India recently boasted that the relationship between the two countries is at its strongest point in history, with New Delhi being a strategic and global partner of Tokyo. Regional observers contend that the two countries as aspiring global powers are perfectly positioned to bring a non-Western perspective to discourse on the emerging global order. Japanese Premier Fumio Kishida's visit to India in March 2022 was significant for multiple reasons. While bilateral agreements signed during the visit will see $42 billion in Japanese investments in India, the visit also reaffirmed Japan's role in shaping India's regional and international engagement. Tokyo has played a key role in India's Look East policy by backing its membership in regional forums such as the East Asia Summit and investing in infrastructure connecting India and East Asia. The partnership between India and Japan has been primarily driven by their aversion to a Sino-centric regional and global order, which also prompted them to join the Quad. While their collaboration had so far focused on the Indo-Pacific region, it is now slowly extending beyond that. This was reflected in the joint statement issued by the two sides during PM Kishida's India visit, emphasizing a special strategic and global partnership. But disagreements remain, especially on the Ukraine war, where they find each other on opposite sides. Quad, by the way, stands for the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, which is a strategic security dialogue between Australia, India, Japan, and the United States that is maintained by talks between member countries.
India and Japan have traditionally exercised strategic self-restraint in their respective foreign policies, mainly due to Japan's so-called Pacific Constitution and India's non-alignment. Both have for long shied away from asserting themselves on the big stage. But this is changing now. With rapidly changing regional and global dynamics, both countries have begun to develop more proactive foreign policies. On the Ukraine conflict, both have adopted strong but contrasting positions. And on China, the two countries have taken calculated risks.
A series of border skirmishes with China in recent years has prompted India to slowly abandon its adherence to the overarching principle of non-alignment and leapfrog into the Western bloc and its informal groupings like Quad. New Delhi has in particular shown great enthusiasm in forging closer ties with countries that don't see themselves as allies of China. Japan, on the other hand, has moved to recalibrate its positions on regional and global affairs in a departure from the country's pacifist foreign policies. Both countries, however, see China's phenomenal rise differently and have framed their responses accordingly. India's relationship with China is shaped by a long-standing power differential rooted in India's defeat in the 1962 war. The recent deadly clashes in the Ladakh region have only accentuated those fault lines. Japan's partnership has been shaped by its age-old cultural and historical ties with China, but that has not deterred it from conducting war games with the US in case of the event of a conflict with China over Taiwan. On Ukraine, both states have different postures. Japan has followed its allies, the United States and Australia, in condemning Russia's military operation and endorsing international economic sanctions against Russia. On the other hand, India has defied its Quad partner states and taken a neutral position while continuing to buy discounted Russian oil.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Dr. Satoru Nagao, an expert on India's military strategy and the Japan-US-India Security Cooperation. Welcome to the program, Dr. Nagao. Now, let's begin with India and Japan's 70 years of diplomatic relations. Can you tell us how far have the two regional heavyweights come to become special strategic and global partners?
Okay, the last 70 years, the relation has moved. Progressed very much. But when our relation has progressed? Indeed, the last 20 years, our relation has progressed, especially since 2000. The relation has progressed a lot. So before the 2000 and after the 2000, completely different. Now we are the strategic partner. But before it, despite that there was no problem between two countries, we are not strategic partner. So now is a good time, best time for India and Japan relations.
Dr. Nagao, how do you assess Japan's role as a shaper of India's regional engagement and broader global outlook, especially the role it has played in India's Look East policy?
Japan focusing on the Indo-Pacific instead of Asia-Pacific, Japan focusing on Quad instead of just the U.S. circle, U.S., Japan, Australia. Why? Because Japan started focusing on India. But why Japan focusing on India? The reason is China. China is dominating the big region, both sides, the Pacific side and the Indian Ocean side. And Japan need to deal with this situation. For India, situation is same. India starts a look east policy in 1990s. Why? Because India tried to find a new chance to develop cooperation with the east side. It's a new chance. It's a Southeast Asia or Japan as located east side of India. But at the same time, the new threat is rising, which is China. Traditional threat, but after the Cold War, China is rising very fast, and China is a big threat for India too. So for Japan, China is threat. For India, China is threat. Now India and Japan should cooperate. That's why the Indo-Pacific vision, the Japan's vision, and look each policy, India's policy, combined, share the same interest.
Dr. Nagao, the partnership between New Delhi and Tokyo has been mainly driven by their antipathy to Sino-centric regional and global order. So how have the two countries framed their responses to China's rise?
When you are a Chinese leader to defend China from other threats, what should you do? In this case, they need to decide to share of the China's military budget against Japan, against India, against others. If India and Japan cooperate each other, China need to divide their defense budget against India, against Japan. In this case, it is more easy for India and Japan to maintain military balance with China. And this is very important because what happened in the South China Sea indicate one pattern of China's territorial expansion. When France withdrew from Indochina, China occupied half of the Paracel Island. When US withdrew from Vietnam, China occupied another half of the Paracel Island. When the Soviet Union reduced the troops, number of troops in Vietnam, China occupied the Spratly Island. When US troops withdrew from Philippines, China occupied Mischief Reef. Every time when the military balance has changed and when there is a power vacuum, China steals it. If so, maintaining military balance is most important way to deter China. If India and Japan cooperate with other US, Australia cooperate, China need to divide their defense budget multi-direction. In this case, it is more easy to maintain military balance. That's why India and Japan share the same interest.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Nagao from Japan for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Mahesh Puttapaka, a journalist based in India, cites a newspaper article to assert that if partnership between India and Japan is to enhance regional security and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific, the time is now. Journalist and editor Benjamin Norton says the U.S. seeks to bring right-wing governments in India, Japan, and Australia together in a Quad alliance to wage war on their common foe, China.
And that was our episode about the simmering economic and political crisis gripping Sri Lanka and the steady progress in India-Japan relations amid rapidly changing global order. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In Georgia, United States, David Perdue challenged Governor Brian Kemp because of Donald Trump's fury over his 2020 election loss. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Reed Epstein and Shane Goldmacher. The piece is titled, Perdue Had Trump, in Georgia, Kemp Had Everything Else. In September of 2021, former Senator David Perdue was hemming and hawing about running for governor of Georgia. Over dinner with an old friend on Sea Island, he pulled out his iPhone and showed the list of calls he'd gotten from Donald J. Trump, lobbying him to take the plunge. He said Donald Trump called him all the time, said Martha Zolla, a former aide to Mr. Perdue, who now hosts a talk radio show in Gainesville, Georgia. Martha Zolla added, he showed me on his iPhone these multiple recent calls and said they were from the former president. Martha Zolla and a legion of other former Perdue aides and advisors told the former senator that running was a bad idea. He listened to Donald Trump instead. Now David Perdue is staring down an epic defeat at the hands of Governor Brian Kemp, the Republican whom Donald Trump has blamed for his 2020 loss more than any other person. The Perdue campaign is ending the race low on cash with no advertisements on television and a candidate described even by his supporters as lackluster and distracted. Perdue thought that Trump was a magic wand, said Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker and a Trump ally, who was among David Perdue's highest-profile Georgia supporters. In retrospect, it's hard to understand David Perdue's campaign, and it's certainly not the campaign those of us who were for him expected. Mr. Perdue's impending downfall in Tuesday's primary for governor in Georgia looms as the biggest electoral setback for Donald Trump since his own defeat in the 2020 presidential election. There is perhaps no contest in which the former president has done more to try to influence the outcome. Mr. Trump recruited, promoted, and cleared the field for his ally while assailing Brian Kemp, recording television advertisements and giving $2.64 million to groups helping David Perdue, by far the most he has ever invested in another politician. Yet the race has exposed the limits of Donald Trump's sway, especially against entrenched Republican incumbents. David Perdue's failures were not just of his own making. He was outflanked by a savvy incumbent in Brian Kemp, who exploited the powers of his office to cut off David Perdue from allies, including Mr. Perdue's own cousin, Sonny, a former governor and Trump agriculture secretary, whom Brian Kemp's allies appointed chancellor of the University System of Georgia. Governor Brian Kemp also appeared to punish those who crossed him. One congressional seat was drawn to exclude the home of a candidate whose father, a Perdue supporter, had publicly criticized the governor. And he offered goodies to voters, including a gas tax holiday that conveniently runs through to the end of May, just past the primary. On Thursday, 19th of May, as David Perdue campaigned outside the Semper Fi Bar and Grill in Woodstock, Georgia, he was not conjuring up a path to victory, but haggling over the scope of his widely expected defeat after a Fox News Channel survey showed him down 32 percentage points on his rival. Hell no, I'm not down 30 points, insisted David Perdue, whose campaign did not respond to requests for comment for this article. We may not win on Tuesday, he added, but I will guarantee you we are not down 30 points. The key threshold on Tuesday is 50%. Brian Kemp must win an outright majority in the five-candidate field to avoid a one-on-one runoff in June. The story of David Perdue's efforts is less one of political collapse and more of a failure to launch. From the moment he announced his candidacy in December, Mr. Perdue never demonstrated the same commitment to winning that he displayed in his first Senate race back in 2014. His case for ousting Brian Kemp was always largely based on support from the former president, Donald Trump. Mr. Perdue argued at his campaign introduction that the governor had so alienated the party's Trump faithful that they would not rally around Mr. Kemp against Stacey Abrams, the presumptive Democratic nominee and a leading villain for Republicans. But Mr. Perdue, a 72-year-old, a wealthy former chief executive of Dollar General, never came close to matching the $3.8 million of his own money he put into his 2014 Senate race. He invested just $500,000 in his bid for governor of Georgia. That is less than he and his wife spent last year for a waterfront lot on a secluded peninsula on scenic St. Simon's Island, a purchase made not long after his runoff defeat at the hands of a then 33-year-old Democrat that delivered Senate control to Democrats. A permit to build a nearly 12,000-square-feet mansion worth an estimated $5 million on land including over 625 feet of lake frontage, according to the listing, was granted 2 weeks after he declared his candidacy, according to records. Donald Trump has simultaneously invested heavily in Mr. Perdue with his $2.64 million and sought to avoid blame as the candidate has faltered, telling the New York Times in April that the news media's focus should be on the endorsements, not the David Perdue one, to measure his influence. Donald Trump's last rally in Georgia came in late March. He did not return to Georgia, as Perdue allies had hoped, instead holding a conference call for supporters in early May. "I am with David all the way because Brian Kemp was the worst governor in the country on election integrity," Donald Trump insisted on Friday on his Truth social messaging platform. David Perdue, like candidates for governor in Idaho and Nebraska this month, learned that a Trump endorsement does not assure the support of Trump voters or Trump donors. "The Trump endorsement is very important, but it's only an endorsement," said former Representative Jack Kingston, who lost the 2014 Senate primary to David Perdue and is a former Trump advisor. "It's not an army of infrastructure and door knockers the way it would be if you have the Sierra Club or the NRA or the AFL-CIO. The juxtaposition between the Kemp and Perdue camps was particularly stark on Friday. Mr. Kemp was outside Savannah, Georgia, announcing that Hyundai was investing $5.5 billion in an electric battery and vehicle manufacturing plant, one of the largest economic development projects in Georgia's history. David Perdue was nearby holding an endorsement event with Sarah Palin, the 2008 Republican vice presidential nominee, who is making her own comeback attempt in a House race in Alaska. "I would rather be standing on the stage announcing 7,500 jobs than standing next to Sarah Palin," said Brian Kemp's Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, a fierce Trump critic who opted not to run for re-election this year. Randy Evans, a Perdue supporter who served as ambassador to Luxembourg in the Trump administration, said the Kemp operation had been ruthless in using what he called the bullying powers of the governorship. Randy Evans' son, Jake, is running for Congress in the Atlanta suburbs. "When Kemp-aligned Republican legislators drew new lines in redistricting, The younger Mr. Evans was suddenly drawn out of the district in which he had been planning to run. They cut a sliver about the size of your little finger, the elder Mr. Evans said. Jake had to move, buy a new house. Brian Kemp, a 58-year-old, leveraged the powers of incumbency in other crucial ways. He signed the measure to provide tax refunds of up to $500 for married couples, then announced on 11th of May, after early voting had begun, that those checks were in the mail. He appealed to rural Georgians by raising pay for teachers and pleased conservatives by signing sweeping legislation to restrict voting access, to expand gun rights, and forbid school mask mandates. David Perdue's efforts could seem feeble in comparison. In March, he attacked Brian Kemp for recruiting an electric truck maker to open a factory in rural Georgia, creating thousands of jobs, because George Soros, the prominent Democratic donor, had recently invested in the company. The Kemp-Perdue contest was steeped in the drama of personal betrayal. Brian Kemp had spent weeks campaigning with David Perdue before the senator's defeat in the January 2021 Senate runoff election. By then, Brian Kemp had infuriated Donald Trump by defending the legitimacy of Georgia's presidential results. Last spring, Brian Kemp's aides said David Perdue assured Brian Kemp that he did not intend to run for governor. That June, Mr. Perdue introduced the governor at the Georgia Republican Party's annual convention. But Brian Kemp cannily had already begun the process of installing Sonny Perdue, a popular former governor, to run Georgia's state universities, an appointment that effectively put him on the sidelines. Sonny Perdue, through a spokesperson, declined to comment. Brian Kemp also preemptively secured the loyalty and fundraising might of Alec Poitvent, a South Georgia businessman who had served as campaign chairman for David Perdue's Senate campaigns and Sonny Perdue's campaigns for governor. One of many ways, the Brian Kemp operation boxed out David Perdue financially. Mr. Poitvent said he was among a host of longtime David Perdue supporters who had urged him not to run. Shunned by the state's political establishment, David Perdue tried framing himself as a political outsider. "I've been an outsider since I got into politics," he said on Thursday. But that is a difficult case to make for a former senator boasting of his support from a former president.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio today our speaker, Sister Razia Batul Najafi. She's an Islamic researcher, and I have had this pleasure to sit with her in the studio today. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
How are you?
Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, we are doing well, both of us here.
Yeah, alhamdulillah. I know you have a very pretty busy schedule. Thank you so much for coming.
No, it's a pleasure.
Sister Najafi, we have a lot of narrations in Islam which are about the upbringing of children and especially about the responsibilities. Like we have this one very, very important question. If parents have some responsibilities towards their children, of course they have. Of course, like parents keep on doing a lot of things towards their children throughout their life. But what does Islam say about that? Does Islam categorize these responsibilities? I mean, what are the responsibilities of parents towards their children in Islamic perspective?
Well, we all are aware of this amazing, very famous hadith, and which I really love it, the way our Prophet and other Ma'sumin alayhi salam, they have given us this message that the most important responsibility of parents towards their children is the way they call them, you know, the name, you know, and as a human being, our name always sticks with us, and we automatically recognize ourselves. We can say that is my identity, you know, like that is me.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe sometimes we don't know the meaning of the name, but still the effects are there.
Yeah.
So naming a good with very, very profound meaning of that name. Therefore, we have hadith that it's better to name with the names of prophets or Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam or any great personalities or something which has a very beautiful and positive meaning.
All right.
And I have read this amazing research of Dr. Emoto, a Japanese very amazing professor, when he does these experiences and some experiments, when he did some experiment on water, and the way he was calling them, the way he was singing something them, or whatever the relationship by, you know, by just the way he talks to them, the conversation towards the water.
Water reacted to
exactly that was something really amazing.
Yeah.
That everyone knows, mashallah, because this this research is, mashallah, very, you know, old research.
True.
But the way we have to connect this research with the upbringing of our children, that is very important.
True.
Yeah. Because we, as a human being, our more than 70% of our body is
consists of water.
Yeah, water or liquid. Yeah, we can say liquid is better. And then whenever we call someone, automatically, you know, that liquid, that 70% of that, this is what we know, but Allah knows better, you know, more deeper, definitely. So whatever I'm calling to someone, the water,
will take the
liquid shape.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So whatever you pour the water into, it's going to take the same shape. Sister Najafi, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. We
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. I have with me Sister Najafi, and we are talking about the responsibilities of parents towards their children. Sister Najafi, you said like you came up with a Japanese researcher, the experiment he did on water. You said like he conducted some experiments where he saw that the names he was calling towards water was reacting the same way, and you connected this with our topic, the way that you said human body consists of more than 74% of human body consists of water, and our body does take that shape, whatever the names we call. So the first responsibility of parents is to give a good name to their children.
Exactly.
All right.
And I think nowadays, unfortunately, we say, you know, we have a beautiful names, but we don't connect with those names to our children.
True.
Sorry, again. Nowadays, unfortunately, we just name our children with amazing and very holy personalities name, but sometimes we as a parents, we don't know, you know, about
we
that
really your personality know about
and the,
yeah,
yeah, the meaning of that name. So I will humbly request to our parents that, you know, it would be so nice, because I remember wherever I go, I say, oh, if your name is, for example, Ummehani, yeah,
all
the
right.
name of sister of Imam Ali alayhi salam, yeah,
right.
Oh wow, Ummehani is a beautiful name. So why you have this name? You know, what is the reason? Sometimes they don't know.
Yeah.
You know, so then I'll say, oh, it would be so nice if you try in your life to write some articles, make some nice, you know, small clips on Ummehani,
yeah,
the sister of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So then they would say, wow, I didn't know. You know, I know that they have given me a beautiful name as a gift, but the connection and the meaning and the hikmah, the reason behind it, mostly will not discuss in a detail. So that would really, really affect. Like I remember here, you know, in Iran, sometimes, you know, when the people, they ask me, what is your son's name? I say Ali. You know what they say? They, oh,
what a beautiful
I sacrifice,
name.
Yeah, to Imam Ali alayhi salam. You know, straight away they are connecting the name of my son, you know,
with
straight
him.
Away they go, their hearts goes to Imam Ali alayhi salam. That is so beautiful.
That's
eh?
So beautiful.
So yeah, that affects a lot. And then second thing, which is the responsibility of our parents, is about how to give them a good education.
All right.
Yeah. So education means a lot. Like it doesn't mean only to educate them, just to send them
to give the secular education.
Yeah, secular education centers or schools, but even the house environment. Yeah.
All right.
And the true education, because we are not only a physical body, we are made of soul and body. So what about spiritual? What about our, you know, actual existence and our actual destination?
All right.
So and knowing about our creator, you know, that kind of education truly you know will
be
the best
treasure
for the children. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So we came to the two points. First was the to go for the beautiful names to, and you suggested parents to do some research on the names to find the connections, to find the meanings, to find spirituality the names contain. And
you know, it would be a beautiful, automatically a good excuse to talk about something spiritual.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, children, they don't like to talk, you know, to give lectures.
Yeah.
So whenever you're calling, sometimes, you know, you just say, wow, my son is Kazim
or Sabir.
Yeah. So
the patient.
Oh, this and that. You know, you can just play around that name and have a healthy conversation with your even teenagers. Yeah.
All right. So we came to two conclusions for now. Like the main two responsibilities are to give a beautiful name and to give them good education. Sister Najafi, I'll be talking to you. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Ya Muqiyya al-Khayrat, Ya
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I have with me Sister Najafi, who is talking about the responsibilities of parents towards their children. Sister Najafi, you said one of the biggest responsibilities is to give a beautiful name to your children, because names have effects. And the second responsibility that you categorized over here was giving them education, a good education. And you said education must not be only for the physical body, a skiller education. It must be a spiritual education as well. Well, are there any more responsibilities that parents have towards their children? For example, is this a responsibility of a parent to be friends with their children? Because today we are seeing children are not able to discuss each and everything with their parent. They sometimes hide things. So do you have anything on that note?
Oh, to have a friendly connection. Oh, yeah. You know, the actual techniques of upbringing we can learn from Allah and Ahlul Bayt and, you know, the infallibles. And we know how our Prophet, he was so much friendly, very, you know, beautiful connection our Prophet would have with companions. So what about, you know, parents, you know, all family, right? Is family. So I truly love the way Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala says sila ar-rahim, yeah,
all right,
like Rahman, Rahim. If I'm not having a good connection with my children or children towards the parents, then maybe I'm not reciting, truly this beautiful verse of Allah, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. You know, like maybe, I don't know, I will say to myself that, you know, I'm not a good parent because I'm saying Allah is Rahman or Rahim, and I'm not that much, you know, mingling with my kids, not playing with them, not having a good, beautiful relationship, and then I'm not caring about the relations.
All right.
Rahman, Rahim, Rahma.
You reminded me of a very beautiful hadith from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him. There's this story. That Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, once was sitting and he was kissing Imam Hassan alayhi salam on one end and Imam Hussein alayhi salam on another end. And a man was looking at them and he told him, like, I have, I guess, more than 5 kids, but I have never ever kissed my kids in my life. And Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, replies that Allah has taken away rahmat from you, the way you mentioned Allah has taken away mercy from you. So being kind towards your children is something that will make you closer to Allah, because Allah is Rahman and Rahim.
Yeah.
Well, Sister Najafi, thank you so much for being with us on this session. We came to the conclusion that parents have some responsibilities to his children that are giving them good names, giving them good education. Imam Al-Ghazali says that one of the biggest part of education is to teach them Quran. And then you said being friends with your children. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. For any suggestions, for any questions, for any feedback, please email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Our website is parstoday.com, wherein you can find all our programs. Going to the option Call of Islam and you'll find our programs. Until another episode, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.